Hello, and welcome to my podcast titled The End for Dr. Death. My name is Abigail Bundy, and this is going to be a conclusion podcast on Dr. Death, hosted by Laura Beale. This is a story about a dangerous doctor and a system that failed to protect the patients. These patients were ones who were looking for a successful neurosurgeon to relieve them of their neck and back pain. They found Dr. Christoffel Dunsch, who had glowing reviews on health grades and on his Facebook page. He claimed to be the best spinal surgeon in the state of Texas. Dunsch worked at Dallas Medical Center, a community hospital just outside of town. This hospital has been around for decades and is one of many hospitals in the area that Dr. Robert Henderson has worked in during his 40-year career. On July 26, 2012, Dr. Henderson was at home when he got a call from an administrator of the Dallas Medical Center. They had a patient who had just gotten out of surgery and wasn't doing well. Henderson was asked to come check on her and correct what happened during surgery. Dr. Henderson is a highly respected surgeon who focused exclusively on the back for most of his career. He has helped assist in developing some surgical techniques that are common in spine surgeries today. Until July 26th, Dr. Henderson had never been called by an administration to take over care of the patient. This patient that was involved was Mary Iford. After surgery, she could barely move her toes or legs. Dr. Henderson studied the x-rays and notes of the surgery. He read the plans for the surgery, all which seemed to be correct. The procedure that was intended to do was not the one that the doctor performed, and Dr. Henderson thought a travesty occurred because the surgical doctor did not do anything planned in surgery. Henderson later learned of a patient from the day before who was in ICU as a result of the same doctor who completed the operation on Mary Iford. These doctors were both Dr. Christoffel Dunsch. The patient who was in ICU from the day before was named Floella Brown. She was 64 years old and had neck surgery a few years before. During the surgery, she had titanium plates installed. The reason she needed another surgery was that her neck and left shoulder was in serious pain. Dunsch was supposed to remove a disc from her spine and attach hardware to combine the two vertebrae together. During the surgery, everything went smoothly for the first 20 to 30 minutes. Suddenly, Dr. Dunsch lost visibility due to too much blood being in the field. The surgery lasted way longer than it should have. Floella lost a lot of blood. However, when she woke up, she felt okay. Later that evening, her husband noted that she was very fidgety. The next morning, when he came to visit her, Floella's body was convulsing. Soon, she lost consciousness. The nurses on call were unable to get a hold of Dunsch. He was supposed to perform another surgery that morning, the one on Mary Iford, but he was late. He showed up about an hour late, looking very disheveled with pinpoint pupils and wasn't really blinking. A nurse thought that he was on something, a drug of some sort, and it was clear that he hadn't changed his scrubs in at least 3 days. Dr. Henderson called the surgery on Mary Iford an unmitigated atrocity. During the surgery, nurses noted that Dr. Dunsch was distracted. 1 hour into the open spine of Mary Iford, Dunsch told a surgical nurse that he wanted to complete a craniotomy on Floella Brown, the patient that was in ICU from the night before. A craniotomy is when the doctor cuts a hole in the skull to relieve the pressure of the brain. This wasn't possible as the hospital wasn't authorized for craniotomies and they didn't have the equipment to do so. Dr. Dunsch said that he was in charge and that the staff should schedule it either way. Dunsch told the nurse to go get his boss, so the nurse got two of Dunsch's supervisors, both of which told him absolutely not to the craniotomy. Out of anger and frustration, Dr. Dunsch left the room with Mary Iford's spine exposed on the table. During his absence, the rest of the surgical team searched for a screw that they couldn't find inside of Iford's body. This screw was supposed to go into the bony part of her spine, but it was clear from the x-ray shown that it didn't. The screw looked to have gone into the muscle of Mary Iford's back and never went into bone. When Dunsch When Dunch returned, he insisted that the screw was where it needed to be. He completed the rest of the surgery in a very confused mess and reinserted and removed a screw multiple times. At the end, he put a screw in her tailbone very awkwardly and stated that he had done it and she would be fine with this surgery. During this operation, Iford had lost almost one-third of her blood volume. She was in unbearable pain when she woke up. She couldn't turn over in her bed and she couldn't raise her toes. The day that Henderson was called into the hospital, he brought her back into surgery. Worrying that Dr. Dunch was incompetent, he videotaped the surgery. Dr. Henderson believed that this was going to go to litigation at some point for malpractice, so he figured that it would be easier to dictate and tape his operation. While he was in the operation field, Dr. Henderson found a lot wrong. He found screws and rungs in incorrect places that weren't solidly placed. He removed fragments of bone that were damaged by incorrectly placed screws, and there were nerves that controlled her leg that were completely destroyed and gone. During the surgery, Dr. Henderson realized that Dunch was operating on the wrong disc for the entire time. Floyella Brown was transferred to another hospital during the recovery surgery on Mary Iford. However, she never regained consciousness. Dunch had punctured and blocked a major artery in Brown's neck with a misplaced screw. There was no brain activity that could be detected, and a few days later, she was withdrawn from life support. After this occurrence, the hospital revoked Dunch's privileges. However, this didn't stop him from going on to another hospital. During his time at Dallas Medical Center, there was one surgery that Dunch had that did not go poorly. This was with Shirley Mock. She had a sharp cramp in the back of her leg that wouldn't let go and remained for 21 days. This patient was 71 at the time and believed that Dr. Dunch seemed nice. He said that he was the best minimally invasive surgeon in the Southwest and that everything would be fine with the surgery. After the fact, Shirley Mock went home with much less pain than she came in with. During a follow-up appointment, Dr. Dunch ordered x-rays. The x-rays revealed fragments of metal and bone out to the side. He blamed them on a fall. However, Shirley Mock had never experienced a fall. He told her that she would need another surgery and that it would have to be performed at a different hospital, claiming that they had more modern technology, although it was a very poor hospital. This follow-up surgery took 6 hours, which was twice as long as the first one, and she needed a blood transfusion. Upon waking up, Shirley Mock was in unbearable pain and was prescribed heavy pain medications that never helped. After the Mary Iford case and Dr. Henderson's involvement, he became looking into Dunch's background as a doctor and if he was truly qualified to complete these very invasive operations. Some background information of Christopher Dunch. When he graduated from top spinal programs in the country. He was born in Montana, however, settled and grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. He went to a Christian school. His family was not as well off as his classmates, but he was a football star, so he had some good opportunities. His father was strict but very devoted to his family, and he pushed his son to do great things. Christopher was driven. He wanted to do things better than anyone once he set his mind to it. He went to Mississippi State on a football scholarship and was proud of his achievement, but he wanted to do better. In response, he tried out for the Colorado State Rams and made the team, one of very few walk-ons. In 1991, Christopher transferred to Memphis State because he wanted to be closer to home. Because of this transfer, he was no longer eligible to play football. However, he reconnected with an old friend named Jerry Summers. They became roommates. During his time in college, Christopher was very forgetful. He was always losing things. His friends joked around with him that he couldn't become a surgeon because he'd accidentally sew something up inside of someone. Without football, Christopher decided to pursue a new passion, medical school. In 1995, he attended the University of Tennessee. He studied stem cells that might contribute to malignant brain tumors. Dunch thought the cells could be repurposed for another use, to revitalize failing discs for people suffering back pain. He conducted research while still completing his medical residency. A medical practice in Dallas heard about Dunge and called his school. His references called him one of the best neurosurgeon residents they have ever had. And soon, Dunge moved to Dallas to start a new neurosurgery practice. He performed only about half a dozen surgeries in the first month. During his time in Dallas, he had his friend from high school who he had connected with, Jerry. Jerry helped him with organizational factors of his life. When it was time for him to do something, Jerry had to come with. In January of 2011, Jerry was going to let Chris do surgery on his neck to fix a football injury that had gotten worse after a car accident. When Jerry woke up from surgery, he couldn't feel anything from the neck down. Chris explained to him that it was due to a complication during surgery and that he had lost a lot of blood, but he would be fine. Chris then took him back into surgery later that same night to see if he could see what was going on. The swelling wasn't going down in his spinal cord, so Chris was going to have to alleviate the spinal cord. During the first surgery, it became clear that Chris damaged the blood vessels and packed the space with gel foam that was constricting Jerry's spine. He had removed so much bone that Jerry's head wasn't attached to his body anymore. Chris believed that Jerry would be okay within a week, but Dunge would not tell him what was going on. Jerry was permanently paralyzed and soon was told that he would have to spend the rest of his life in a nursing home. Later on, it became understood that Chris never seemed too upset with the outcome of his surgery. Jerry got lucky and never ended up having to live in a nursing home, thanks to his girlfriend who took care of him. Today, Jerry and his now ex-girlfriend, Jennifer, don't speak anymore. The rage he had as he was recovering caused him to treat her poorly, and they cannot have any relationship of some sort. In August of 2011, an attractive nurse practitioner became working for Dr. Dunge. This woman was named Kimberly Morgan. Dr. Dunge became sleeping with her, even though he had a girlfriend who was named Wendy Young, and she was 5 months pregnant with his son. Dr. Dunge told Kim that Wendy was his secretary, while he told Wendy that Kim was just his assistant. Dr. Dunge frequently contacted Kim through email. There's one specific email that will come into very important use later on in this podcast. In this email to Kim, Dr. Dunge states that he was ready to become a cold-blooded killer. We'll keep that in mind as we talk later on. Less than 2 months later after this email was the operation of Jerry Summers. Looking back, while Dunge was in residency, he spent more time in the lab than in the operating room. It became understood that he performed less than 100 operations during his training. He should have never been let out of residency. Once he got to Dallas, he formed a company and began looking for investors. Once he found some, his partners began to determine that he was too problematic for a long-term relationship with a business. Christopher Dunge would get drunk at dinner parties or at morning meetings, and once a partner found a bag of cocaine in his desk at work. Dunge suffered from a serious drug abuse problem. He was a frequent user of LSD, cocaine, and alcohol. Soon after his drug abuse problem escalated, Dunge's partners kicked him out of the company, and all that have left of him is his name on the original business patent. Dunge and Kim had sexual relations inside of his office frequently after the move to Dallas. When asked about it later, Kim revealed that she considered them to be dating. Dunge's partner at the Spine Institute that he got been hired at had no idea of his drug and alcohol issues. However, they cut ties with him once they had seen enough disturbing behavior that was concerning. While Dunge never injured a patient at this institute, his partners fired him due to clear, irresponsible activities. This didn't keep him from operating at Baylor Hospital in Plano, and there was nothing stopping him from the possibility of opening his own practice. Early in 2012, Dr. Dunge operated on Barry Morgulov at Baylor Plano. Before completing the operation and visiting Dr. Dunch, Barry Morgulov had found only positive online about things about his doctor. His operation would involve discs. In an unusual spine surgery, the neurosurgeon would remove the diseased disc and insert hardware that would fill the hole and hold the two vertebrae together. This is called an anterior lumbar fusion and is seen to be the easiest surgery for neurosurgeons. While this is what was expected to do for Barry, Dunch did not do this method. Instead, Dr. Dunch used a different tool that caused bleeding. He was gouging into the bone of the spine, and it caused immeasurable pain for Barry when he woke up. Dunch prescribed lots of pain medication, even though Barry was an opioid addict from his past, and the pain medication did not work as well. Just before Barry Morgulov completed his surgery, Lee Passamore was operated on by Dr. Dunch. During the surgery, a vascular surgeon who was assisting on the case tried to physically stop Dunch from continuing with the surgery. It was seen that no patient after Lee Passamore would escape without injury. 2 weeks after this was when Dr. Dunch wrote the email about becoming a cold-blooded killer, and this was all before he operated on Jerry Summers. After the failed surgery on Jerry, Baylor's CEO ordered Dunch and Kim to take drug tests due to rumors about drug abuse issues. Dunch's mistress, Kim, had taken the test right away, but Dunch stalled, making up excuses. When he finally took the test, it came back clean. Dunch took a voluntary leave while Baylor CEO and administration completed an investigation towards him. He passed a psychological exam, and after 3 weeks, he was cleared, but was instructed to stick to minor outpatient procedures. Doctors assisting Jerry in his care after Dunch was investigated believed that his career would be over after this terrible mistake. However, he was allowed to complete these outpatient procedures. The next disaster surgery was seen to be on Kelly Martin. She needed a simple outpatient procedure that was believed to be pressure on a nerve. This procedure was so simple that Baylor officials believed that he could fly solo. This procedure should have taken about an hour, however, it stretched toward 3 hours. During this operation, Kelly's blood pressure dropped and her pulse became racing. When she went into recovery, her legs looked very weird. She was in terrible pain, and Dunch claimed that there were some operations, but otherwise the surgery had gone well. This wasn't the case at all. Kelly's abdomen had filled with blood due to Dunch puncturing a major blood vessel by her spinal cord. This caused her to bleed to death. The next day, Dunch was ordered another drug test. It came back diluted, which meant that he had put tap water in his sample and led to the conclusion that he had failed his drug test. He was called back several days later to take another one, which was clean. Baylor investigated Dunch and concluded that he did not meet the standard of care for either Jerry or Kelly. He performed these operations horribly. However, Baylor Medical Center did not fire him or report him to any state or federal authorities. After Dunch was suspended, Barry Morgulov came back to see him because his pain did not go away. Dunch claimed that the pain had nothing to do with the surgery he completed, so Barry went back to his original surgeon and found that the digging into his vertebrae Dunch had done left bone fragments in the spinal canal, compressing a nerve root. Today, as scar tissue is continuing to build up in his body, Barry continues to lose function on his left side, and nothing can fix him. After these occurrences, Baylor didn't want Dr. Dunch at their hospital anymore, so they took away his privileges. During the spring and early summer of 2012, Dunch had no privileges to operate at any hospital. Kim quit after Kelly Martin died. She claimed Dunch was crazy and she didn't want to be associated with him anymore. He kept having patients come see him, although he could not operate on them, even though they seriously needed it. Every patient that Dunch operated on since December 2011 had major complications, whether it be pain, paralysis, or death. Soon, he went on to the Dallas Medical Center. Two of his three surgeries there were a complete disaster. After the failure of Jerry Summers, Dunch operated 29 more times. This was allowed because Baylor Plano allowed his departure to seem voluntary. They failed to report him to the state medical board or to the National Practitioner Database, which was a way of keeping up with the world's worst doctors. This prevented doctors from sneaking from hospital to hospital, just like Dunch did. Baylor made it seem like Dunch left on good terms. Since they didn't fire him, they didn't have to report him or worry about facing a potential of heavy legal bills. Dunch or the patient's families could have sued Baylor for malpractice or for unlawfully firing him without enough evidence. The Dallas Medical Center didn't report Dunch either for his poor surgeries. He was finally reported by the Methodist Hospital in Dallas, in a Dallas suburb near McKinney. While Dunch never worked there, he applied, and the administration heard what happened at Baylor, so they rejected him and reported him to the medical board. Alan Shulkin sat on the Texas Medical Board in 2012. He got a call from a fellow surgeon regarding Dunch. He reported to the Dunch to the board, and this was the first report the medical board had received. This started a very long and slow process, which is an investigation that will take months to complete. Had Baylor done this report when the issue first began, Dunch's license would have been suspended within the next few days while the investigation occurred, so that he could not interact with any other patients. It's believed that issues like this happen often. Hospitals weren't doing anything to stop Dunch. Since he wasn't getting reported, hospitals had no way of knowing what was going on or that anything was going poorly. Doctors didn't hear anything. They believed that his mistakes had caught up with him and he was no longer practicing. One of the doctors investigating Dunch was called to help with a woman who had suffered severe complications from a cervical spine injury. Her name was Jacqueline Troy. The incision was infected, her vocal cords were cut, and her windpipe had a hole in it. The doctor had a hunch over who performed the surgery, and he was correct. It was Dunch. Jacqueline survived, but her voice is now nothing more than a raspy whisper because her vocal cords never recovered. In June of 2013, Jeff Glidewell broke his back in a motorcycle accident over a decade earlier. In 2012, he developed a pinched nerve in his neck. He found Dr. Dunch and had him repair the issue in his neck. However, future reports revealed that he retained a foreign body in his neck. During this operation, Dunch was supposed to remove a diseased disc. However, he made an incision in the wrong place in the neck. He went through the left lobe of the thyroid gland and destroyed it. Dr. Dunch proceeded to then cut through the left side of the esophagus and drilled a hole in the neck lateral to where he should have been. These holes were two ping pong ball sized holes in the musculoskeletal area of the left side of his neck. This injured an artery that caused serious bleeding, and to stop it, Dunch shoved a sponge in the hole and then closed him up with it in there. Glidewell didn't have the neck surgery that he needed to repair the pinched nerve until 2015. Based off this, the doctor called in to help believe that this original surgery was way past malpractice and said he believed that this was attempted murder. He skipped contacting the medical board and contacted the Texas district attorney. On January 31st, 2013, Robert Henderson called the Texas Medical Board. A few months later, on June 19th, 2013, Jeff Glidewell was recovering from the infection the sponge left in his throat, an email hit journalist Brett Shipp's inbox. Brett Shipp was one of the best-known reporters in Dallas at the time. This email was asking him to investigate Dr. Christopher Dunch. 2 hours later, Brett Shipp got an email from a plaintiff's attorney that he knew. This was also a story regarding Dunch. The attorney claimed that it was a story for him regarding the safety of the public. 4 days later, one of the doctors who was investigating the Dunch situation sent an email to the lead investigator at the Texas Medical Board. He informed her that he was going to urge the Texas DA to arrest Dunch and put him in jail, as that was the only way to stop his madness, and he believed that the police were the only ones capable of getting to the bottom of this issue. The medical board had been investigating Dr. Dunge before this letter and before SHIP began investigating. Almost a full year after the medical board received its first complaint against Dunge, on June 26, 2013, his medical license was temporarily suspended. In the fall of 2013, the doctors who were investigating Dunge on their own went to the Texas District Attorney. They met with an assistant DA, and they explained to him that Dr. Dunge was a serial killer and maimer of people seeking help in the healthcare system. Nothing happened for a very long time. The DA investigated and found that his license was suspended, so they were not concerned because he couldn't practice medicine or interact with patients. On December 6, 2013, the medical board permanently stripped Dunge of his license. 10 days later, he filed for bankruptcy, having over $10 million in debt. Soon after, Brett Shipp released articles on Dunge, calling Baylor out for letting an unqualified doctor complete dangerous surgeries that should have been stopped before being allowed to operate. This made a very private situation bright in the public eye. All of Dr. Dunge's victims suddenly became aware that they were not alone in their mistreatments or injuries. After this, Dunge moved to Colorado to live with his parents. In January of 2014, he was pulled over by police in southern Denver at about 3:30 a.m. Officers stopped him because he was driving on the left side of the road with two flat tires. When Dunge opened the window, they smelled alcohol coming from the car and saw empty as well as full alcoholic beverages in the car. He was arrested for a DUI after a breath test and was sent to a detox facility. While he was living in Colorado, Dunge continuously kept visiting Dallas to see his two sons. In 2015, Dunge was arrested for shoplifting a pair of pants and sunglasses. However, in addition to these two items, he has stolen another $837 worth of merchandise from a Walmart. By this time, there is a new district attorney in the Dallas County. Michelle Shugart, an assistant DA, overheard one of her chiefs talking about the Dr. Dunge case. She began doing her own research to help out and then ended up taking over the case as she became very interested in it. Shugart had a hard time figuring out what Dunge should be charged with, since no doctor had ever faced criminal charges for something that happened in the operating room. The situation of Mary Iford was where she made her decision. Since Iford was over the age of 65, she's considered to be an elderly person by Texas law. This allowed them to raise the punishment range so the jury could have the full range, which was 5 to 99 years or life in prison as an option. There's also the fact that he had killed two patients and made his best friend a quadriplegic. That showed he should have never went into Iford surgery. There was an issue of how close they were to reaching the statute of limitations. They were 4 months away before they were going to run out, and by the end of those 4 months, Shugart had overwhelming evidence to indict Dr. Dunge. The prosecution team was taking on a case that was entirely new to the justice system. They put together an indictment for not only Mary Iford, but the five cases of aggravated assault, including Floella Brown and Jeff Glidewell. On the July 21st, 2015, the prosecution team found out that Dunge was in town while they were planning on indicting him. He was arrested, and it was believed that Dunge did not realize the magnitude of what was going on. He believed he would be able to talk his way out of this just like he had everything else in the past and would continue to get away with it. Dunge claimed in his first interview with the police after being booked for arrest that none of his actions were criminal. As his charges were being explained to him, Dunge explained each case to the officer as if they were completely routine. Shugart spent the next year and a half after Dunge's arrest collecting evidence and witnesses. She found through investigation that there was, in total, 38 patients, and she spoke to every one that she could. 33 of those patients were in more physical pain after their surgery was completed, and at least 20 of those faced permanent injuries that would never go away. Meanwhile, two of Dunge's 38 patients had died after their surgery. Three days after his arrest, Dunge's bond was set at $600,000, which was $100,000 more than the starting point for capital murder. Dunge became worried that he would not be able to defend himself legally from in jail, and despite everything, he remained positive that one day he would be able to return to the life of practicing medicine. Christopher Dunge's trial began on February 2nd, 2017. He seemed confident that he had not done anything wrong throughout all of his time in jail. The prosecution team had decided to base their case around elder abuse, since Mary Iford's surgery was the one on trial. If they had gotten a conviction, Dunge could be facing life in prison. During trial, the prosecution team talked about his other cases, though. This showed that Iford's case was a part of a pattern and not Dunch's first botched surgery. During the trial, the prosecution painted a portrait of a surgeon who should have known that he needed to stop operating and practicing medicine. Mary Iford, as well as other capable patients, took the stand to testify against Dunch and his actions. There were over 8 days of testimony during this trial, and each day a patient took a stand and told their own story in full detail. The widowers of Kelly Martin and Floella Brown both testified as well. In order for the jury to make a decision, they had to learn about neurosurgery. A well-known and respected neurosurgeon, Dr. Lazard, took the stand to teach the jury about his craft. He walked the jury through everything that was done wrong by Dr. Dunge. He explained to the jury, with easy words and anatomical models, exactly what happened versus what should have happened in the operating room. It was during this testimony that Dunge's defense think that Dunge realized just how terrible of a surgeon he actually was. On the sixth day of trial, Christopher Dunge's ex-girlfriend, Kim, was called to testify. And this is where the email from before came into light. The concept of him calling himself a cold-blooded killer was used against him, and it was clear that Dr. Dunge meant harm. The defense called only one witness, which was a neurosurgeon as well. He was not used to testify to Dunge's ability as a surgeon, but rather to place blame on the medical system as a whole, instead of just Dr. Dunge. On February 14, 2017, after 8 days of testimony, the jury left to make a decision. It took them only 4 hours to reach a verdict, and then an hour to decide on a punishment. Dr. Christopher Dunge was convicted of injury to an elderly person and was sentenced to life in prison. He is believed to be the first doctor in the country who has been tried in court for the way he practiced medicine. During this event, people wondered why Christopher Dunge did the things he did. Some believed he just didn't realize how bad of a surgeon he was. Others claimed it was pride that pushed him to keep working harder. Some credited greed, ego, substance abuse, or simply the fact that he was a sociopath or a secondary psychopath for the reasons he did what he did. The actions of Dr. Dunge affected not only the 38 patients that he operated on, but each of their families as well. These patients and their families tried before his trial to find justice in the form of civil lawsuits by filing for malpractice. But they have a cap, and almost no lawyer would represent each victim, as cases like those tended to not be worth their time or money. This led to their extended suffering and dealing with the pain of their lives being changed forever by an unqualified and dangerous doctor. In addition, the medical community was also affected by this case. Clearly, many steps in the medical process failed to protect the health of the public, and this case forced each hospital and the entire medical board to pay diligent attention to the mistreatment and poor actions and outcomes by doctors everywhere. Thank you for going on this journey with me as we evaluate the podcast titled Dr. Death, hosted by Laura Beale.